Now, if you're just joining with us, joining in today, if you're new with us, welcome here, or maybe you're returning after being away for a while, welcome back. It's great to have you. But just to get you up to speed where we're at, we're in the midst of our series called Join In, and we have began to explore the book of Hebrews. This is our guide. This is the book that's leading us in this series. And what we have learned so far is that the author makes pretty bold statements and declarations in his book. And if some of you have started reading ahead, you might be thinking, oh my goodness, this is some pretty black and white statements here. Like, what is happening? And so we're going to explore that today. But as he began over the last 2 weeks, and as we've said, is that he starts out by telling us that God has spoken. That God has spoken in time and space through a variety of ways, through a variety of people. And he has spoken through his prophets, priests, and kings. He has done this. But then he shifts his thought to declare that today, God speaks most clearly and definitively in Jesus. And so we have seen this unknown author of Hebrews, and actually, maybe than saying unknown author, maybe a better name for him would be pastor, because this whole book really reads as one sermon. That's why it's kind of an unusual book in the New Testament, the second part of the Bible. It kind of reads like a sermon. So I'm just going to call him pastor because it feels he's just like, he's preaching. He's preaching in this book. So what the pastor of Hebrews is saying is that all the ways the prophets, priests, and kings, all the ways that God has spoken through them and has done this in the past, and we'll call that the Old Testament, the first part of the Bible, in all the ways that God spoke, showed up, guided, instructed, in all those ways, all that time was good, but it was always actually pointing to Jesus. All of the story of God, all of the scriptures were always leading all of us to Jesus. So the book of Hebrews has this pastor has this in his sermon, has this pattern that he kind of teaches us, and you'll see as you read the book. He seems to go back to the story of God. He goes a lot of times he seems to go right to the first Genesis account of the book. So he goes back to the story just to then pull us forward, to pull us forward to Jesus, to help us anticipate what God is doing in our midst right now in Jesus himself, what he's doing in us and around us. So we see this pastor consistently unpacking, exploring, creating parallels of Israel and God and our story and God, and then ultimately revealing Jesus in the midst of it all. And so as I said last week, this pastor is doing this, as he's teaching this, as he's speaking, as he's writing his sermon, he actually carries a lot of assumptions in his writing. He knows his audience. He's writing this to a group of people that he knows. And he knows that they know the Old Testament. They know the story of God. They know the Israel story. They have been steeped in it. So he knows they know that. But more than that, he knows that they actually know the nuances of the Jewish religion. Like, they know all the little details in between the verses that we might not catch. They know the Jewish faith really well. So these assumptions are just embedded in the book, and the readers know this because they're steeped in it. So to help us navigate this book, because we just don't carry the same knowledge of the Old Testament, we don't know all the nuances often. So to help us understand this, one of the things that I invited you last week was to practice Lectio Divina. Now, if you're new with us today, what Lectio Divina is simply slow reading of the text with repetition. You read it in order to listen, to hear, to absorb, to apply God's word, and you reread the same passage. And last week, I invited you guys to read chapter 1 and chapter 2, and this week, I'm going to invite you to read chapter 3 and chapter 4. It just helps us get really familiar with the text, because I can't cover all the things that are in it in each chapter. There's just so much stuff. And so this will just be a helpful way to absorb as we're learning along. And it's a great thing to have in your home church to have a conversation, because God will reveal different things to us in different moments. So in your home church, you can bring these things up and talk about, what does this mean? Or God has spoken this way, or I have never noticed this. So this is just a great spiritual practice to participate in. And if you're like, yeah, but I'm not really sure how to fully do it. We talked about how to find it online, so we do have that information. So after the service, if you're interested and you're not sure where to find all the instructions and information, just find me or Kurt or another pastor in the lobby or at the info desk, and we can help you find where all our spiritual practices are located online. And finally, there's a lot of books that I've read for this series, but a couple that I'd like to recommend that we have in our bookstore is N.T. Wright's Hebrews for Everyone and the Commentary on Hebrews by Anderson. So just a couple of resources because there's just a lot of dense information. All right, infomercial over. So over the last 2 weeks, we asked two questions as we unpacked the first two chapters. We said, if God speaks in Jesus most clearly, are we listening? Like if he's speaking to us in Jesus, are we listening? Are we learning the language of Jesus? And then last week we learned that God had given humanity authority right in the intended creation and order of things, right in the first book of Genesis. God gives humanity authority. And if he does give us authority in Jesus, we ask the question, how will you rule? How will you rule? If God has given you authority, and each and every one of us has received a kingdom, whether it's large or very small, each of us has received a kingdom to rule in this world. And so the question stands, how will you rule in Jesus with what God has trusted you with? How will you do that? Will you lord over it? Or will you, like Jesus, serve the kingdom given to you? These were our questions. Now, these questions arise because the pastor of Hebrews has this distinct concern for his original audience. Like he's just not putting stuff down because he has a lot of theology knowledge and he's just like, oh, God is like this, so I'm just gonna, I don't think he typed, I don't know how he did it. But he's not just sharing that because he has a lot of knowledge. He actually has a concern for this church he's writing to. And in today's passages in chapter 3 and 4, we'll actually see a clear and passionate, urgent message that he has for the community. And he's concerned and he's urgent about it because he knows them really well. So right off the bat, one of the things that should perk our imagination is that he actually knows this church. He's not just writing to like audience out there in the blog somewhere who will read this. Like he knows this group of people, he knows this community, and he knows what's happening in their lives. This is why this is kind of like a sermon. Like he's like, I see what's happening, I'm concerned about it, and I want to speak into it. So let me write this sermon for you. And so he's addressing really urgent, real-time concerns he's observing. Now, what is helpful for us to note is that as we read these concerns in the chapters, we'll note that his concern in these two chapters particularly are concerned with the people's hearts. He's worried about their hearts. And I think this is important for us to know because the concerns he has for their hearts are the concerns and things that that our hearts are susceptible to. There are things that our hearts have temptations to follow. So although he's writing to a particular audience, there are many things here for us to check, and we'll see how he parallels this. So this pastor is writing to this Jewish community. And one of the things we know right away is this community itself seems to be kind of all over the map spiritually. Like they're just all over the map. Based on the writing, what we can deduce is that some of the people in the church have been like believers for a long time. They have believed in Jesus and it's been quite a while, but they've just kind of stalled out. And they just don't know what to do with their faith anymore. And it seems like for the author anyways, that they're just not growing. They're just kind of like, yeah, I believe, but my actions may not actually represent what I believe because like life is complicated. And so he's concerned about that. And he sees other people whose hearts are actually becoming quite hard to the faith because they're experiencing problems and they're like, well, where's Jesus in these problems? And so their hearts are becoming stressed and hardened and shaped into a different direction. And yet other people in this community are beginning to actually face persecution for their faith. They're actually facing danger because of what they believe. And they're beginning to wonder the questions behind their persecution is this worth it?
Like, is it worth it that I'm, like, I may die for this. Like, is it actually worth it for me? So you could see how the pastor is really concerned about these questions and all the stuff that this church seems to be navigating. So he begins to challenge them and us to examine our hearts in light of Jesus. So to do that, the pastor begins to appeal to some of their heroes. Like, they're questioning things about Jesus, but they're so deeply rooted in their Jewish national reality and who they are and their roots and just their culture. So even though they're questioning Jesus, they do have these heroes of the past. And so the author begins to, like, juxtaposition their heroes with Jesus. And he does this thing, which I keep saying, he pulls them back to God's story. Or sorry, he appeals back to the original story to pull them forward to Jesus. So last week we looked at this interesting chapter where he juxtapositioned Jesus in light of angels. Again, something like the original audience understood what was going on. There's this authority structure. And so he's appealing that Jesus is greater than angels. And you can see how this is like part of the Jewish imagination, but it's something we really don't think about. But we know that the heart of this is actually authority and how you will rule. But today, in our passage, he juxtapositions with a more known character. He juxtapositions Jesus with Moses. Now, Moses is way more familiar to more of us, anyways, maybe most of us. If you grew up reading the Bible, if you come to church, you've kind of heard of Moses. Or if you have seen Prince of Egypt, you're like, hey, yeah, Moses, that guy. Like, he has this thing, his chariot races and stuff, and it's all animated. It's really fun. So you may be familiar with Moses this way, or if you're like a really seasoned, you know, movie watcher, you may recall the 1956 classic, The Ten Commandments. Some of you may even have the songs and the things come to your mind. Really, really good story. Or if you really love like religious movies and you watch them because they're like, well, I'm interested, I'm a sucker for punishment, and you love these kind of movies, especially the ones that flop, and you're like, oh, these poor actors, they got paid a lot of money, but like their craft was just not accepted. You may know Exodus, Gods and Kings, truly a terrible movie. But you may know Moses because of reading the Bible or some of these stories or movies or things you've learned in the growing up. And we know that Moses, in all of these things, is the key figure in the story of Exodus. In fact, the 1956 classic calls it the greatest epic of all time. Paramount Pictures said it's the greatest epic of all time. And it's true because this is a story that completely captures the Jewish imagination. Right? Moses is this great leader, part of their imagination. He was this revolutionary that led them out of slavery. He did all these amazing things. He is like the man in their story. And so for the pastor to make this statement that Jesus is greater than him is actually kind of a bold and incredible claim that Jesus is greater than Moses, because Moses is this hero of faith. And you could write endless books on Moses, and some people have. There's just so much stuff rooted in God's story with Moses. So Moses is a massive hero, and just naming him, the audience, the original church, would have had all these stories percolate in their minds. They remember, you know, the baby in the basket and how God provided and saved by him coming into the Pharaoh's house and learning all the, you know, the education of this great empire, and then how he killed an Egyptian and ran away, and then there was this time in the burning bush. All these things are just percolating in people's imagination as Moses is mentioned, because they were steeped in these stories. They were steeped in these scriptures. And so the pastor in Hebrews writes this. He says, Moses was certainly faithful in God's house as a servant. His work was an illustration of the truth God would reveal later. But Christ, Jesus, as the Son, is in charge of God's entire house. And we are God's house if we keep our courage and remain confident in our hope in Christ. Moses is known for saving Israel out of slavery. And here we quickly see that the author already begins to juxtaposition him with Jesus. He's drawing these parallels. He says, yes, he did this, but look what Jesus does. And he brings this imagination to us of the story and how it actually connects to that original church and how it connects to us. Now, Moses led his people out of Egypt, but they actually find themselves in between land, in between Egypt and the promised land. They find themselves in this in-between, in the desert, in the wilderness. And they find themselves in this wilderness, and we learn that this time in the wilderness is actually a time of testing and rebellion. And it's actually, and I don't know if we always pick this up because of the movies or because of the how we read the Bible, it's actually a really, really dark time. Like, it's not a fun time. It's not like, oh, they just failed some tests, but they'll do better. It's really dark time. It's messy, chaotic. There's violence. There's betrayal. There's sickness and illness and disease. There's death. There's murder. There's a lot of chaotic things that happen in the wilderness. And the original readers would not have missed that. And so we have this story where same people who celebrated leaving Egypt, who were celebrating God and saying, God, Yahweh, you're the best, you're the greatest, we love you, this is so good, we're out of slavery, just a little bit later are now grumbling and angry and find themselves stalled. And they're not convinced if this was all worth it. They're not convinced if this kind of freedom is actually better than their life in Egypt. They're facing hard times and beginning to wonder, was it worth it? Was Egypt that bad? Are you listening? The author begins to open our imagination to the parallels of story of Moses and Israelites to our story and God in Jesus. The questions of, is it worth it? Now, my recap of Exodus is clearly just a small, quick summary of what happened. And of course, there's much more and nuance and all those things. But the culmination of the story is the rescue, and the journey to the place of rest. The place of rest. And this rest in the Exodus journey is the promised land, which for the people and the original readers was the real land and place in the Middle East in Canaan, is a real place where they were going. That was going to be seen as the promised land. But the pastor clearly begins to draw parallels of what was, looking back to pull us forward. And in the heart of this message is that Moses navigated and led the people through a time of rebellion, a time of testing, a time in the wilderness of uncertainty and chaos and murder and violence and betrayal, in a time of weariness where many failed to enter rest because they found themselves not trusting God and actually longing for Egypt. So for the rest of the chapter of Hebrews, the author plays this idea back and forth, the wavering and the rebellion, the inability and fear to enter rest. And his encouragement for them and for us is to strive, keep striving, join in, don't give up, hold on, because the rest is there, it's coming. The promised land is awaiting. Now, a couple of things. In the Bible, Egypt is a place and a country and a nation where the story begins. But the biblical imagination of Egypt, like Babylon, is also much, much more than just a geographical place or just a nation. To understand how central Egypt is to the flow of the entire biblical story, we actually have to go again back to the Genesis account of the Garden of Eden. Note how the author of this, or this pastor, as we saw last week, whenever he juxtapositions the heroes to Jesus, he always goes back to the intended order. That seems to be the thing for him. He always goes right back to what Jesus intended, what God had intended in the garden. And so the original intended order in the garden, we are told that there was Adam and Eve, there was original people. And as the order was made, the people chose to go their own way. They chose to decide for themselves what was good and what was evil. They chose for themselves how to rule. And when they did that, they stepped outside of God's intended purposes. And what happened was that this choice is immediately followed by the story of their son Cain killing Abel. This is rapid and like dramatic progression, like from Adam and Eve to sons. They've gone from like eating fruit, like stepping out of God's will, to murder in one generation. Like things began to fall apart very quickly in the story. Intended order to chaos. We start with two people and their choice, which escalates into murder among family members, which then escalates to the entire civilization at odds with God's people, at odds with God and his intended purposes. Okay, how are you guys doing? There's a lot of stuff I'm unpacking here. Are you guys tracking? Are you guys with me? You guys all right? A couple people are? Okay. All right. So the world, what I'm saying is the world is not as it was intended to be. What was meant to be a garden, a community, a family, is now growing to be this machine that's consumed by desire of power. And to gain this power, he uses violence and uses any means available to it, and it swallows up and enslaves people. In the Bible, Egypt represents this. Right? Are you listening? Egypt represents this violent power that stepped outside of the intended purposes and began to swallow people up. So for the author of Hebrews, he takes the story of leaving Egypt as a reminder to his readers and to us that these stories actually parallel for us. That they too had found themselves, that the original readers and us as well, we have found ourselves enslaved in the machinery of power at all costs. We live in structures of Egypt today. That we too find ourselves and our hearts shaped by Egypt and its powerful machine. Their hearts and our hearts are shaped by imagination of corruption, power, greed, abuse, and lust. Their hearts have been shaped, and our hearts, I want to suggest, are often shaped by Egypt. So in Jesus, we actually enter a similar journey. In Jesus, we begin to leave Egypt. We begin the journey to rest from Egypt. We begin to enter a rest that is still available and was actually always more than land. Look what the pastor says. He says, God's promise of entering his rest still stands. A couple of things to note. That first of all, that it still stands. And secondly, it says his rest. His rest. Not a country, not a land location, but his rest. What's God's rest? What's that? Where do you remember God resting? Anyone? Genesis, right? We go back. This is the whole structure is like we just go right back to Genesis. Genesis 1, creation happens. God does all these amazing things. He creates the good world. He makes very good humans, and then he rests. And then he actually invites us to rest with him. This has been there and completed and created and awaits us. And God rests. And the author, so he goes back to pull us forward, right? Rest is created, it's completed, and it's awaiting us. And in this parallel of the Moses story and the Jesus story, the author says, join in, don't grow weary. Don't lose hope, don't turn back. The rest is available. He says, yes, in Jesus, when you leave Egypt, your journey, it doesn't become all perfect. Your journey becomes that in-between land. It's hard, it's confusing, they're stalling out. And he's appealing to the reality of the following Jesus is actually hard. He's appealing to the reality that we find ourselves in the wilderness, that we too find ourselves in the in-between land of Egypt and rest, promised land. So he's drawing us back to just remind us that just because you're in Jesus and you're learning the language and you begin to rule in Jesus, it doesn't mean things will just become super easy. That the land we're in is in between and it has testing and it has pressures and it has chaos and it has violence and it has sickness and it has all those things that we hate. So following Jesus is not simple because the world is not as it should be. It is not in its intended purposes. And our hearts, just like the hearts of those who followed Moses, our hearts are messed up. They're also in the in-between land. And they're messed up in this in-between land because our hearts have also been shaped by Egypt. Our hearts long for the intended order. We long, it's part of our story because we find ourselves in the God story when we go back. It's part of who we are, the intended purposes. We long for that, but we confuse them for the power structures and the easy answers of Egypt. We confuse Egypt for rest. We confuse slavery for freedom. So the pastor sees this in his church as well, and so he appeals in light of this current wilderness we all find ourselves in to not lose hope, to remain, to hold fast, to join in, to trust Jesus, to speak and listen in Jesus, to rule in Jesus, don't turn back, hold tightly to your faith. Yes, it's confusing. Yes, it's hard right now. Yes, it's complex. Yes, there's death, and we wish there wasn't. And he says, look, God is doing all he can to make everything possible for us. We read, he continues, so God set another time. He set another time for entering his rest. And that time is today. God announces through David, much later in the words already quoted, today when you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts. Don't harden your hearts. Look, this is so brilliant. These chapters, like, there's just so much stuff in them. And I can't stress enough how much you should, like, make sure you reread this in your home church and on your own through Lectio Divina practice. These people in the desert have hardened their hearts to Moses and to God, so much so that they wanted to go back to Egypt. They wanted to go back to slavery. They'd rather do that. Why? Because it's all they know. It's familiar. Because it is the shadow of what their hearts actually long for. It looks like rest. It looks like the real thing, but yet it's a shadow. It has similarities. There's food, there's schedules, there's authorities, there's work, there's things to accomplish and go up the scale in the ladder of success. It appears to give us what we need while in reality enslaving us. So much so, you know what? Let's look at what the people said to Moses in Egypt. If only the Lord had killed us back in Egypt, they moaned. There we sat around pots filled with meat and ate all the bread we wanted. But now you have brought us into this wilderness to starve us all to death. Is this wilderness worth it, God? Wasn't slavery better? Like, isn't it worth seeing all this sickness and injustice and corruption and poverty and wars and violence? Is this really worth it? Isn't me striving to get power and take authority and to make things maybe better my way, isn't that better? Friends, Egypt lies at the hearts or at the center of all of our hearts. And he gives us shadows of what actually rest looks like. Egypt in the Bible is an empire. In fact, at that time, it was the most powerful empire of all time. And the biblical imagination for Egypt is that it actually represents this large system of complex webs of power and violence and industry and technology. They're building bricks that exploits people for its expansion and profit. It represents a power structure that is building, growing, consuming at the expense of people. It uses people as means of production, enslaving them. It's antithetical to the garden and the intended purposes of God. It works people to death. Egypt represents all that is anti-human. Egypt represents anti-rest. Are you listening? Egypt in the Bible represents the evil in the individual human heart that chose to step out of the intended purposes of God and has gathered speed and is now embedded in the fabric of this world. It's anti-human. Egypt is paralleled to us by the pastor of Hebrews as what happens when our hearts are hardened by the wilderness. And so we turn back to the kingdom of slavery and violence because this is what we know, because it's the power we understand. Egypt is the dark shadow of the promise we receive in the garden. If rest is the garden that God intended, the family, the strengthening one another, the leveraging our abilities for each other, the caring, the patience, the love, the humility that all the garden kind of held, if rest is that in the intended order, Egypt then is using one another, abusing one another, elevating yourself over others with a promise of power while being enslaved.
So it is as if the author of Hebrews is saying that Egypt will capture your heart's imagination. It will shape your heart with its lies and hope full of food, and you could live on all the bread you want. And Jesus says, man shall not live on bread alone.
He exposes the shadows of Egypt in the wilderness. When the wilderness is too hard, Egypt is what you know. Egypt is what we want to turn back to. Egypt compels us, doesn't it? It gives us easy answers. Well, yeah, you're not in charge. That's why things are bad. Once you're in charge, things will be better. You would do it better, for sure. Egypt compels us into shadows. Friends, the author, the pastor of Hebrews, is compelling his church. He's compelling us. Don't let Egypt shape your imagination. Don't let Egypt contain your heart. Don't let Egypt shape your heart. Don't let wilderness harden it by wanting to go to Egypt. And so our question for this week, our question for us today is, who or what will shape your heart? Is it Egypt with all its power and might and glory that really leads to slavery? Or is it Jesus, the one who invites you into a family? And there's a clear juxtaposition that the author is playing in these chapters of slavery and daughters and sons. Are you desiring to be a slave, or are you desiring to be a daughter and son? Who will shape your heart? Will it be Egypt, or will it be Jesus? Because today, too, we find ourselves in the wilderness. And the journey isn't easy. I'm not selling you something that's easy. I'm not telling you something. If you just do this stuff with Jesus, all your problems will be solved. We're in the wilderness. We're in the in-between land. It's complicated and painful and complex. And our hearts just long for rest. So will you look to Egypt to find your rest? Or will you look to Jesus? Who will shape your heart? Would you pray with me? Jesus, we thank you. We thank you that you entered this world. And we thank you that your story clearly indicates that you entered wilderness and was tempted. Yet you did not give in to the pressures of Egypt. You did not bow to the powers and authorities and wills that this world seemingly offers. That you conquered that which we can't. So we trust in you. We learn to speak in your language. We learn to have authority in you and through you. And we ask for you to shape our hearts and our imagination. Help us, though, in this time of wilderness, because you know it is not easy. Give us strength when we are weak. Praise in your name. Amen. Amen.